Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Go ahead and be seated, counsel. All right, our next case on this docket is case 65409, Helstein versus Ira and Edith Seaver Family Trust. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Oakes, if you want to come up.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Oakes, the firm of Foley & Oakes. Mr. Foley, my partner Dan Foley, is here with me. We represent the petitioners in this case. This case involves questions regarding the finality of settlements. My client was one of two defendants sued in a business case. Prior to his filing of any sort of responsive pleading, he settled out. This came about as a result of 10 months of negotiations. And he got a mutual release and settlement agreement, and the case was dismissed by a notice of voluntary dismissal under NRCP 41A11. After that, the case proceeded to trial against the other defendant, and the plaintiff obtained a sizable verdict. 3 years and 4 months after that dismissal, and approximately 11 months after the trial, the plaintiff filed a motion which they labeled a motion to set aside rescinded settlement agreement under 60B. We assert that it was an abuse of discretion for the lower court to do anything other than deny that motion, and that was the basis for our filing this petition. There's a couple of peripheral issues, but that's the central issue. The order directing answer asked us or directed us to focus on three issues, and I want to spend some time, first of all, on two of those. I think those two issues are directly intertwined, and I think they're central and fundamental to the disposition of this case. And both, the reason they're intertwined is because they each require a determination of what is that dismissal under 41A. Is it a judgment? Is it an order? Is it a proceeding? If it's not a judgment, order, or proceeding, then it's not subject to relief under 60B. That issue ties, therefore, into the first issue of whether 60B can even be used to relieve a party from a settlement agreement or a 41 dismissal, and if it can, when does the time begin to run? Our position is that 60B is intended to relieve a party from the effect of some judgment or order made by the court in its regular proceedings, not to give a party some affirmative right which they have lost by their own conduct in regard to which the court has made no order whatsoever. That's a quote from a very old case way back in 1866. It's cited in our brief, Killip versus Empire Mill. That same standard of relieving a party from action taken by the court is part of the language of 60B itself, in that it provides relief only from a final judgment, order, or proceeding. With that in mind, is a settlement agreement any of those? It certainly isn't. It's not a final judgment. It's not an order or a proceeding. I don't think anyone could argue that 60B would, in and of itself, allow a party to be relieved from a written settlement agreement, which is a new contract. Secondarily, can 60B be used to relieve a party from a voluntary dismissal under A11? Again, it provides relief from a judgment, order, or proceeding. That dismissal is not an order. The language of 41A itself says an action may be dismissed by the plaintiff upon repayment of defendant's filing fees without order of court. Subpart 1, by filing a notice of dismissal. There's no order involved.
Counsel, we have a suit that was duly commenced. We have some side issues about whether or not there was adequate service or not adequate service. No answer having been filed. The parties enter this. It's a voluntary dismissal on this. Pursuant to a proffered agreement, I understand where you're going. There's some case law that talks about extrinsic fraud, if that be the case, providing a window to come back before the court where they can show some kind of a manner of activity that would preclude a party from going into court to extinguish their rights or to attempt to vindicate their rights. In this particular case, how do we look at this, if we need to look at it at all? And even if we say, for some reason, this partially might come back, is there a service issue in play, or lack of adequate service that always can be raised for jurisdictional purposes?
The jurisdictional issue that we briefed, Your Honor, was a minimum contacts issue, which the lower court said we waived by virtue of coming to this court and getting an order to compel arbitration. I don't think that is consistent with the law that we waived it as a result of that. It didn't reach any of the merits. There were no factual allegations made by the other side when we filed our jurisdictional argument. Instead, they and the court, having tried a case where I wasn't present and my client was not a party, merely wanted to talk about things he maybe said in that case where he was there as a witness, but not as a party, and where he wasn't represented by counsel because he wasn't a party, and use those things to justify minimum contacts. On your other point about whether there's a different breed of fraud, and 60B speaks in terms of an independent action, for instance, and it gives you more time to bring a motion if you want to assert an independent action. It's a different type of fraud. It's fraud only to correct a grave miscarriage of justice. And most important, what I'm saying is it is subject to the same limitation that I'm describing here. It still is correcting actions taken by a court. It's still correcting a judgment, order, or proceeding. This voluntary dismissal is not one of those. Moving on that same point, I've already addressed, dismissal is not an order. Secondarily, it's not a judgment. Rule 54 defines judgments, and it says judgment as used in these rules includes a decree and any order from which an appeal lies. A dismissal under 41A is not an appealable determination. Therefore, that judgment, by definition under NRCP 54, that dismissal, rather, is not a judgment based on NRCP 54. It's not a judgment. It's not an order. It's carried forth based upon the language of the Jeep Corporation case. It occurs without any judicial sanction or affirmation whatsoever. So the only other problem it could be is a proceeding. Well, this is a proceeding. We're proceeding here, and we're having a hearing, and we're proceeding with this proceeding. But, again, a proceeding, it's not defined in NRCP, but if you look at NRCP, Section 8 consists of Rules 64 to 71, and it talks about special proceedings. And they're all things that require court action, court involvement, court intervention, injunctions, receivers, executions, proceedings to determine responsibility for fees and costs after offers of judgment. All of those things are things where the court has involvement. I submit that that definition of proceeding points, just as with judgment or order, to court action. With a notice of voluntary dismissal, there is no court action. It happens automatically. It's not an order. It's not a judgment. And it's not a proceeding. And based upon that, 60B is not a proper basis to set aside a settlement agreement or to set aside a voluntary dismissal submitted prior to an answer pursuant to 41A11. The second point then goes to the timing. I think beyond any doubt, you can't say this is a judgment or an order. The only thing that really even gives rise to discussion is it a proceeding? We submit that it's not. But if we're wrong and you decide otherwise, the time runs from the time when the proceeding was taken. It runs from the time when the thing happened. There is no language in 60B that suggests final judgment for purposes of appeal as being the trigger for that. The specific language says the motion under 60B shall be filed not more than 6 months after the proceeding was taken. That occurred a good 3 years and 3 months prior to the time of filing of the motion. And therefore, even if you can use 54, or rather 60B, to attack a 41A dismissal, it's still not timely in this instance. There is no Nevada case that comes out and says a 41A dismissal, a 41A1-1 dismissal, can be attacked by 60B because it is an order, or because it is a judgment, or because it is a proceeding. Nor should there be any such case, because as we submit, the plain language of the rule makes it very clear that it's not, as by the definitions themselves in 41A, which says the dismissal is without order, and by 54A, which defines a judgment of which this is not.
So I guess, in a nutshell, your position, this being, since nothing was done by the court, then if, depending on any limitation statutes, the party's only ability to come back in would be an independent proceeding.
And I submit that this language about independent action that is contained within 60B carries the same limit that I'm talking about. In other words, if you look at the very last sentence of 60B, it says, procedure for obtaining any relief from a The procedure for obtaining any relief from a judgment shall be by motion as prescribed in these rules or by an independent action. It's relief from judgment. This isn't a judgment. This is not a proper case for an independent action, nor is it a proper case for a 60B motion.
Well, it would not have any preclusion.
Pardon me?
It would not have any preclusion, preclusive effect.
The dismissal?
The party could not assert, you'd be unable to assert that the party is voluntarily dismissed. Party voluntarily dismissed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand your question.
Maybe it's how I'm phrasing it. Your position that the prior action is ineffective, has no effect whatsoever, is that correct?
My position is the case was settled, a voluntary dismissal was entered. You can't use 60B to attack that, and you can't file an independent action for correcting a grave miscarriage of justice by the court because there was no court action.
Well, and I guess that's my concern, is the whole policy issue with 60B is primarily to ensure finality of these matters, and I'm not sure I've seen an action, right? A particular situation where you've got a voluntary dismissal, and then the use of 60B to come in and crack that open. And I know the federal courts, there's nothing in Nevada that we have specifically on point, but I know that federal courts are somewhat all over the board on that issue. And I don't know how significantly you have evaluated some of those federal court decisions.
I gave you what I could find, Your Honor. And so my answer to that, and that's why I spent time talking about the rules. I don't think it's tricky under the rules. The rule says you get relief from a judgment, an order, or a proceeding. A dismissal is not one of those. It's just not.
Would you ever have finality in a voluntary dismissal if 60B were allowed to operate?
Would you ever have finality? In this case, finality, I suppose, would come, if the lower court was right, 6 months after the trial between the remaining parties had a final judgment entered into it, as though you're waiting on that dismissal as a interlocutory order to become final for appellate purposes, and that's not what it is. That's a wrong analysis, so I think the lower court's thinking on that was wrong. You wouldn't have finality in a case like this until final judgment was entered against all the parties on all the claims for appeal purposes. This is not that. This shouldn't be tied to that. As we are saying, we're 4 years out. Any settling party shouldn't have to keep the file open, awaiting the possibility of a 60B motion for that long once they settle. You're paying for getting it over with, and that's what you should get. Thank you.
I want to reserve your 33 seconds for rebuttal.
Yes, please. I would like to.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if that was a question. I'll try to be efficient with it if it comes up.
I'm sure you will be. Good morning.
Or good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, sir. Good to see you as always. Jeff Albrecht's appearing on behalf of the respondent on bar number 66, and with me today I have my associate, Krista Albrecht, also by way of disclosure, my daughter. So that's how old I'm getting, I guess.
Now. Welcome.
More in the family. As well as my clients, Mr. and Mrs. Siever in the audience. In any event, moving to the exact issue that you gentlemen were addressing a moment ago with Mr. Oaks, the problem we have here, in my mind, is we got the cart before the horse. It's premature. In order to make all these determinations, Judge Gonzalez has to be allowed the opportunity down below to hold this hearing. And if she holds the hearing, Mr. Oaks' arguments may very well hold water. They may very well have a good basis. But until she holds that hearing, one of the dilemmas I thought of before I got up here and argued is if you ask me a whole bunch of questions that I would have to respond and say, I really don't know until we get down to this hearing and put this case on as to whether there was a fraud upon the court or not. Also, derivatively, in that hearing, the court would determine when the six-month limitation would run, from when it would run, whether it was blown. There's a myriad of issues that would need to be considered before this came back up here. And it's not as black and white as or clear or distinct lines as Mr. Oaks or counsel would have you believe. In the Jeep case, I found the following language, which in my mind left the door open at 98 Nev 444 and the 445, and it said, and such determination was made without a hearing and was contrary to the position of the parties and was without evidence of fraud or overreaching on the part of any parties or the counsel. That's the situation we're in here. We haven't had the hearing. We haven't had the opportunity to show fraud. Judge Gonzalez wants to give us that opportunity, but Mr. Oaks and his client don't want to avail themselves of that opportunity or submit to that due process. It also seems that your decision in the Valley Hospital versus Garner case, which we cited in our brief, 218 Pacific 3853 site here. I don't have the Nevada site in front of me. It's a 2009 case, but that's the case that refers to holding a proper hearing, albeit in the context of a fraud upon the court case where the attorney involved had stolen the money from his clients.
If we can turn though back to the basic premise, we have an action filed, we have purported service attempted and or made, no answer having been filed.
Correct.
And the parties reach some kind of side agreement and the plaintiff comes in and says, I want to voluntarily dismiss this action. So isn't it over as if nothing ever happened?
No.
Why not?
Certainly an argument can be constructed on that basis, Your Honor. The reason it's not over, and timing is always somewhat of a dilemma in what we do, but the way this broke down, and I'm sure you gentlemen have followed it, is we filed the case in... been around quite a while, I think 2009, what we call the UI defendants, the other set of parties for whom the Summit defendants, Mr. Oaks represents, were adverse, they answered in November of that year. The dismissal was also entered in November of that year. The UI defendants then cross-claimed in January of 2010. A motion for good faith settlement was filed in February of 2010.
Counsel, they had multiple defendants, but as this defendant, they didn't file an answer. I know the other defendant
right.
did. This one didn't. They were let out of the case. That's what a voluntary dismissal is.
The short answer, which set forth in the briefs, I understand, is that after the voluntary dismissal was entered, we hired an expert witness who finally did a forensic accounting of the books, and the entire settlement on which, and I'll get to your question very quickly in chronology, and I apologize for taking the time to do so, but it showed an abundance of fraud on the part of Mr. Helstein and the Summit companies. And then the issue became Mr. Helstein going to court and testifying, and this is where Judge Gonzalez is at, and basically putting into testimony and evidence that same fraud that he had perpetrated upon Mr. Mr. Seaver, my clients, the Seavers, and then the court, at that point in time, as you recall, back in April 11, you guys had entered, excuse me, the Supreme Court had entered the stay order as to Mr. or the Summit Companies and as to the UI defendants. So the lower court interpreted that from that point forward as not being able to address any issues as to the Summit Companies, which explains a lot of the timing. But the fact of the matter is, an issue that you raised, Your Honor, to get directly to the question is, hey, Albrechts, you did a voluntary dismissal, you did it for a reason. If those reasons were procured fraudulently by the other side, go file an independent action on that. Don't bring it back to this court.
Let me ask you one question.
My answer is, Judge Gonzales, Your Honor, still needs to hold this hearing before that determination is made. Thank you very much, Justice.
And my question may be a little off subject, but in February of 2010, after the settlement was already reached, at least my impression was there was a request for a motion for good faith settlement that was brought. Is that correct or incorrect?
No, that is correct, Your Honor.
And during that particular hearing, were counsel present, or was it something that was submitted?
The motion for good faith settlement was taken off calendar at that time, and the following month in March, at or about the time we started discovering the accounting evidence.
Okay.
And the fraud that had been perpetrated on my clients.
Okay, so there was never any determination on the motion for the good faith settlement?
No, Your Honor. And it was actually opposed by the other parties, the UI defendants that are on the other side.
Right.
Was there any thought of an independent action of any type? Was there any independent action that could have been filed? I'm trying to think of what. And this, once you discovered with the forensic accounting, that, in other words, don't just an independent action.
Justice Chair, you raise an excellent point. I mean, I've sat there and cross-examined myself, questioned myself on the decisions made along the way extensively in this case. At the time, we were stayed as to the Summit defendants, so we had to put our case on as to the UI defendants, and part of the problem was we didn't know what we would recover and what we would prove putting that case on with the UI defendants. In comes Mr. Hellstein without counsel testifying as a witness and not a party, and he basically testifies contrary to all of the accounting and bookkeeping evidence that was in the record, and they never had an expert to rebut Mr. Conant. In fact, Mr. Conant's testimony and evidence is the only thing showing that this guy basically was able to scam $1 million or more off my client, and they recovered a substantial portion of that, and I'm bound by confidentiality, so I don't think I can tell you the terms of the settlement with the UI defendants, and I think I got spanked once down in the lower court for doing so. But in any event, it seemed that during that time, we were prevented from filing any kind of independent action until we had the hearing and the trial before Judge Gonzales, and she had her findings. And when we brought the issue up to her, she said, file a motion with the court, which is what we did. And then she basically entered this order for which this petition arises. It says, I'll hold an evidentiary hearing, not on the claims, not on the complaint, Justice Douglas, it hasn't been answered yet, but solely on the issue of whether a fraud was perpetrated on the court. And then the answer to your question, Justice Cherry, would be that if she were able to hold that hearing and hold it soon, I may, and we would lose, and you folks would disagree that we could do that. There may be the possibility of an independent action filed by November of this year, since the settlement agreement was entered into and the voluntary dismissal entered into in November of 2009. The six-year statute of limitation on the written settlement agreement would run in the fall of this year. But my position and problem with this is, and I think it always befuddles us and gives us a clear picture of why it stands out. You know, in law school, you're always asking yourself, this doctrine of fraud, it has different evidence, it has all these exceptions and everything else. And what basically it boils down to is, do the rules of 41A that say that it's dismissed without prejudice unless it was another proceeding or claim, do they bar this court or any court from considering a dismissal that was procured by fraud? And my answer to you, based upon the Jeep case and your Valley Hospital Garner case, is that no, what this court has seemed to indicate and say in this situation, even though we don't have any law on it, and as Justice Perry points out, the federal courts are all over the place on it, which is unusual, that you can have an evidentiary hearing to make these determinations, as well as the other findings that may help answer the questions you're asking both of us here better, and that's something that we haven't been able to do yet because they brought the petition up. My position, in sum and substance, is let Judge Gonzales hold this evidentiary hearing on the issue of fraud solely on the procurement of the settlement agreement and the continuation or perpetration of that by the Summit defendants through the trial with the UI defendants and go from there. It's a unique case.
It's unique, and I guess your position is it doesn't make any difference whether it's a voluntary settlement or whether it's a judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
That's the distinction.
That is. I don't know if you have any other questions. On the jurisdiction issue, I can point to Mr. Halstein's testimony where he's got a Nevada corporation. He's an officer and director, and he came here. The court has specific impersonal jurisdiction over him. There's no doubt, without getting to the waiver issue. And I really think it would be a disservice to the parties, to the resources involved in the system, to disqualify Judge Gonzalez simply based upon her expression of the evidence after hearing the evidence at trial. Mr. Halstein's problem with the judge is that she found him to be an incredible witness, which doesn't provide a basis for disqualifying her for the same reasons that Judge Kadish had decided she shouldn't be disqualified. So I'd ask you to deny that part of the petition, and all I'm asking is that you allow us, I think that's me, that time up.
You still have 5 minutes.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah. That's the 5 minute warning bell.
I can't reserve to go after Mike?
No. What's that?
I can't reserve to go after Mr. Halstein.
No. You don't need 5 minutes?
It's been a pleasure litigating the case with Mr. Oakes. Unless you have any questions, that's basically all I have to present. I can point to the language in the Valley Hospital case. My plea is simply to allow my client the opportunity to go down before Judge Gonzalez and put on the evidence as to why there was a fraud perpetrated upon the court and this voluntary dismissal. They shouldn't be bound by that, nor should they be required to go through the considerable time and expense of having to file another independent legal action after all these years. And this is also on the record. And maybe you can get away with this. You know, there are the perfect crimes or scenarios or frauds in life. But Mr. Halstein is a very crafty guy. He's a New York attorney. And how he avoided ever having to come here to testify is kind of interesting in and of itself, because the judge insisted he was going to testify at trial, and all of a sudden we received these medical excuses and he's testifying by video. So my last pitch to you is that it's been constructed from day one by Mr. Halstein to not ever have to come to this jurisdiction and account for his conduct without ever having to face due process and notice an opportunity to be heard by Mr. Siever, his only mistake being reaching a settlement before he made, if that's a mistake, any discovery. But again, you're entitled to rely on the truthfulness of representations and parties in litigation with whom you're trying to settle your differences. Thank you for your patience and your time, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Rex.
There was never any stay of anything on the part of the plaintiff. There was a stay of the cross-claim third-party claim as between my client and the claimant. Plaintiff was never stayed from anything. If you take everything they say as true, there was no fraud on the court under 60B. If you have a hearing under 60B, it has to be based on mistakes or excusable neglect or errors or irregularities in the course of the judgment order or proceeding. That's not the case here. You can't use 60B to attack the 41A11 dismissal.
Simply because it was a voluntary dismissal and doesn't fall into the category of any of those three aspects.
Yes. Yes. And then, of course, if it did, it could only be a proceeding, and then it's 6 months from the time of the filing of the voluntary dismissal itself.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you all for the briefs and the excellent arguments today, and this case will stand submitted.